We are going to work with what is called ascertaining the three vows. It's a backbone of Buddhist practices. Just as without the spinal cord, the body wouldn't be able to function. In the same way, without maintaining the disciplines of the three vows, there's absolutely no way you can actually benefit from being a Buddhist or through any of the engaged practices. So the three vows, the Pratimoksha vows, the Bodhisattva vows, and the Tantra vows. Tantra vows, we'll get to there if we get there. Bodhisattva vows, that's something that is probably more looked forward to. Sometimes when I talk to people, they say something like, I'll see you on Wednesday night. And I take it as, okay, so it's the Bodhisattva vow that does it. So Pratimoksha vows, I'm actually very surprised to see a room full of people, is always not the most popular one. Pratimoksha vows, those of you who are new, means solitary realizer's vows. Prati and moksha. Prati means individual. It's a Sanskrit term. And moksha is nirvana or enlightenment. A path of discipline engaged in by an individual who wishes to, aspires to, or wishes to realize enlightenment for oneself. So that's the general sort of definition of the term pratimoksha. Today, in the very colloquial sort of way of approaching, it is associated with monks and nuns, those who have taken on monastic traditional vows, male monks and female nuns. So that's why I said, since you're studying pratimoksha vows, then it means you have to be a monk and a nun, which is very important. Because, of course, in all the social niceties and your Western way of being politically correct, teachers have so far in these last over five decades of Buddhism left Buddhism very abstract. So sort of do what you can, as you please, when you can, however it may be, the best as possible. Those are all the terms that are very nice to hear. Is it right to do so? One can't be very sure, because when will you give up? Yesterday, as I drove into New York, I was joking with Jetsun La, my sister, and the nuns, and I was saying, looking at the sheer number of people, the tourists, especially in the area where we are now, seems to be very popular with tourists of all nations. And so there's the busyness of New York, the shoppers and the tourists and so forth. And I was telling them, so you're supposed to teach them renunciation. And it's true, isn't it? You are there, I am there. And however, if you stand in the middle of the street and you begin to look at the approach that Buddha Dharma takes, and it's all nice when we talk about enlightenment. If I were to stand in the middle of the street and ask someone, would you like enlightenment? Chances are a lot of people will be quite happy to get it. Now, if I ask them in the middle of the road, would you like to renounce samsara? That might not go very well. So what I'm pointing out too is leniency and a sense of convenience is a very dangerous thing to attach to. There is a lot of wisdom and a lot of correct, I think, truthfulness in the perspective that every person must work in accordance to one's own potential. Of course, doing it as you can, as best as you can. And that is very important. On the other hand, all of you whom I have known very personally for many years, I know you to be some of the most dedicated practitioners, doing the best you can. In comparison to some of you, I know that even very traditional monks and nuns may not be as diligent or as dedicated or devoted to the path of practice. So that's the good thing. But on the other hand, the human mind is a very tricky mind. And the transition that it has to make in order to be able to overcome causes and conditions that are disruptive and harmful to oneself and to the others, which is the very core essence, core meaning of Buddha Dharma, because why are you practicing Dharma? Why do we teach Buddhist tradition practices? Why do we engage in meditation or the teachings of the Buddha? Is only for the simple reason that the Buddha taught the importance of each individual cultivating an insight and a wisdom that would be able to allow oneself to recognize one's own basic nature. If you look carefully, that's something that should be done by everyone as a human being who has such a wonderful capability and a potential to think and to process that thinking, should at some point also delve deeper into one's own self to say, what's my true being? What's my true nature? What is it that it is at the very core from where all kinds of messages seem to be coming from? So from that perspective, Buddhist teachings emphasizes, now through the 2,500 years of Buddhist tradition, a lot of religiosity has come into Buddhist practices also. Not because someone wanted to sort of bring up a different kind of ideas or different kind of practices, but as I said in the beginning, human mind has very much a difficulty in working with abstract things. If it says truth, and if it is left abstract, very often we may like that idea, but we won't have anything to hang on to. When you don't have something to hang on to, you forget very easily. As it is, the sort of rapidness with which our mind and our body functions, the forgetfulness becomes very, very easy to succumb to. Therefore, some structure, some reference has to be given to that truth, even to that truth. So when that kind of a necessity evolves, we do find that very simple doctrine of Buddha, that as he taught 2,500 years ago, over the years have developed a lot of references, a lot of different kinds of conceptual ideas, which we today call different methods of meditation, contemplation, different kinds of teachings, lineages, practices, and so forth. However, the core, in spite of that, one must, however, not forget the core of the Buddha's message, of the Buddha's teaching. And that is that each human being must cultivate a very deep introspection and recognition of one's own fundamental nature. Who are you? What am I? What is my true nature? That has to be recognized. Not because it is something profound, but simply because it is the powerhouse from where all messages are coming that is then building up the personality that you have become. That I always say is set loose into society. Isn't it? So who we are, how we behave with one another, how we interpret things, how we articulate things. And based upon that interpretation and articulation, how we behave with one another. Now, if our behavior and interaction individually to ourselves, in relationship to other beings, and particularly the creation of the environment that we live in, if it was only about a sort of a one-way direction that the process worked, and you could give out a lot of actions, you could say a lot of things, you could behave and develop a personality as you like, and it did not have consequences, then it would still be okay. But there are massive consequences to our personalities. Our personalities and our attitude and conduct creates the environment. An environment that would be good if what is being projected is good. An environment that is full of aggression, full of pain, full of confusion, chaos, if what is being projected is chaotic, is something that is neurotic. Therefore, one must also understand that who you are projecting, what your attitude and your behavior is projecting, what your personalities and beliefs are projecting, does have enormous impact on the environment, and that bounces back at you. And so the Buddhist teachings, which say everyone looks for happiness, nobody wants suffering, that very simple phrase that is repeated again and again, basically is trying to convey this idea of what is the very fundamental belief of Buddhist tradition, and that is the power of cause and effect. Causes are created, they're very powerful, they immediately generate an effect, a consequence that is individually and directly experienced, that is collectively experienced, that is indirectly experienced. And so The basic sort of logic in this would be is that we are all responsible for whatever situation we create. If you take, and there are many exercises, very good exercises that are there today in various religious traditions as well as in the field of mind science. If you take 10 people in a room and you encourage them to be chaotic and neurotic, the reverberation and the resonance of chaos and confusion that can create, even when all 10 have predetermined to be nothing but nice to each other, patient with one another, there comes a time when that patience and the niceness breaks and one becomes very subject to whatever environment is created within it. It makes you further project greater neurosis, or in some cases, it makes you so much introverted that you begin to isolate yourself from everything else. But what is seen is the resultant state of effect that causes and conditions that can actually generate and sort of be experienced by us. So the Buddhist tradition talks about cause and effect. Now, you all know, most of you who are practitioners, we have nothing to believe in as a Buddhist. We are left with sort of emptiness is, of course, nothing to believe in. That's one thing that is often said. Nature of mind is empty. Nature of individual is empty. Nature of phenomena is empty. So that emptiness doesn't leave us anywhere. It's too abstract. But what we do have, that what we believe to be even more powerful than the creator, the God, is cause and effect. And therefore, cause and effect are constantly created. It impacts your life. It impacts the lives of the others. But they are not sent from the heavens. They're not controlled by somebody else. We would love it if cause and effect was, you know, some kind of sent by some, like the Greek mythology, I always found very interesting, is that somehow all of the gods have this sort of a chessboard in front of them. I don't know how much the Hollywood movies are accurate. My Greek nun over here always teaches me Greek sort of religion in a much better way, but much of my education is from the Hollywood movies. So in those cases, the gods seem to always be taking people around and really messing up their lives, you know. So just sort of, if you look at cause and effect from that perspective, it's a very simplistic way to look at it. Then there is somebody to blame. But on the other hand, the Buddhist tradition doesn't believe in that. Buddhist tradition believes each individual being, if we take the 7 billion human beings, each individual is responsible for creating causes and conditions that impact your life, that impacts the lives of the others. So therefore, the first thing is you realize and recognize your responsibility. I am a Buddhist. What does that mean is somebody who realizes this. It's not about which teacher you go after, or whether you've been to Tibet several times or India many more times, or pilgrimages, or you hang all these pictures on the wall, you know, buy all the Buddhist items, are a member of sanghas, you pay your membership dues, you read your books, you attend the seminars, you lock up yourself in retreat rooms and cabins, and, you know, those are all nice things to do because you are in this world. And in samsara, we have to come up with new ideas every year, isn't it? But that's not what being a Buddhist is. Being a Buddhist is, are you aware the impact your actions of body, speech, and mind are making to yourself and to the others? If that awareness itself is missing, what's the point? What's the point of sitting in meditation? What's the point of devotion? What's the point of aspiring for enlightenment? What do you suppose an enlightened person does? What do you think an enlightened person does? Something, well, they sort of get spaced out. Some think it's a very cozy place from where they can not be touched by the murkiness of samsara but still dwell in the midst of it. Some think, I don't know what it is. But those are all the spiritual materialistic ideas of what we assume conceptually. This conceptual mind assumes enlightenment to be. Enlightened mind, to be enlightened, is the perfect mode of awareness, where there is such a genuine realization of your pure nature that you do not anymore succumb or fall prey or become blackmailed by suppositions of those thoughts, suppositions of those afflictive emotions that presupposes what your nature is, what is not. Let me go back again. Buddha's teachings itself therefore says, inherent basic nature is pure, period. Now, what do we think? The same thing that I talked about can be approached in this way. What do we think our nature is? What we think our nature is are all mind's afflictions that supposes its nature to be something which in actuality it is not. So as a person, it is good to sit down and think, what do you think is your nature? If you think your nature is myself, from the Buddha's teachings, it says it is not that. If you think my nature is to want, then the Buddha's teachings say, no, it's not that either. My nature is to think of things. Is that what it is? If you look closely, you'll find these are all different suppositions. We think, we never question. So I always joke with our Buddhist practitioners, and I always say, you all are very cautious about everything, especially New Yorkers are even, you know, you're very cynical about many things. So you're very cautious before you commit to anything, but you never question your mind's neurosis ever. Some of you, I'm sure you do. But most oftentimes, be greedy, you never question that. Be aggressive, you never question that. Be selfish, never question that. Be selfish to that degree where you forget the well-being of the others. And you never question where that thought comes from or how logical it is. We just think, yes, I should be hopeful. Yes, I should be fearful. Yes, I should chase after everything. Yes, I should just let my mind run rampant after everything without really actually sitting down to think, why am I doing this? It's about, let's say, sometimes it happens when a person says, run, and everybody starts running. And after a while, then you ask, why am I running? It is in the same ways that where we engage in everything that we do to a point where physically we become exhausted. Look at your own lives. Tiredness is there. Exhaustion is there. Questions are many. Confusions, a lot. Non-clarity is what we live with. Clear and aware of how many things. But we never question that. We think there is reason why we behave the way we behave. There must be a reason. Otherwise, everybody wouldn't be doing this. So if you look carefully at, you know, if we look at all, if we look at all the different sort of, one of the metaphors, if we look, all the sheep who are together, and they're all sort of moving together, you know, sometimes you have to think, does a sheep ask a question, why is this formation necessary? You know, the kind of formations that the sheep go into. Just as they don't come up with a question, but are herded into certain things, human life, as intelligent as we might suppose it to be, are not so dissimilar from that kind of a mentality where we do a lot of things. Everybody gets angry. Nobody says why. Nobody likes it, but it's always agreed that we have to be angry. Jealousy is one of those things. Really not needed. When every day each one of us wake up with the thought, hope this is going to be a day that is happy, untouched by problems, and it goes off without any kind of challenges or difficulties or suffering or pain. But we still go on into creating a lot of neurosis within ourselves, project it outwardly, contribute greatly to creating greater neurosis, and the life we live in. So individually, if you take that to your own introspection and contemplation, you have to say, if you look at the anger that you live with, that's a very simple way to look at it and say, why must you be angry? And people say things like, how can I overcome anger? There is no method to overcome anger other than to drop it, not to be angry. Of course, As again, there are lots of other explanations. Breathe, visualize, recite mantras, go here, go there, try compassion, look at the suffering, look at impermanence, look at the emptiness. Each kind teacher will come up with whatever has not been touched on and advise you to do that. But it will never really be something you'll be able to give up until you give it up. But why do you keep it? If you find it difficult to give up, then you have to then ask that question, why do you keep it? Nobody tells you to do so. There is no religious belief, even if you're not a Buddhist, that encourages to hold on to that. Primarily, if you are a Buddhist practitioner, you're supposed to overcome that. But one holds on to this. Selfishness, self-cherishing attitude, self-absorption are the same. Then, all the different tendencies of laziness, of convenient ways of approaching, self-deception, tendencies of various ways of being unmindful. Those are also not necessary, but we succumb to that. We sustain that. Jealousy, competitiveness, we sustain that. Pride and arrogance, of course. There's nobody at the end of your life that you can run to and say, see how well I have sustained my ego. You know, it's been untouched and kept safe from everyone. You know, we are never going to be able to show it off to anyone. But we maintain it, we keep it, we walk around with that pride, with that arrogance, with that ego, a whole life. And that's not for a week, a month, a year, but an entire human life. And then if you to that combine or add the consequences of such an attitude, then suffering is created. So what the Buddha taught is not knowing what one's own true nature is, falsely, ignorantly believing what it is not, never questioning it, never challenging it, one ends up creating so many causes and conditions that builds up to becoming the environment in which we live. And if you look at that carefully, one cannot be but compassionate and feel sorry for oneself and all sentient beings who dwell in that state of ignorance. So as a Buddhist, the generation of this insight is necessary. And so there is no outer external causal conditions that can be changed to bring about a healthy, happier existence. Even in that supplication, may all sentient beings have happiness, be free from suffering, and enjoy equanimity, you have to have a very realistic approach and say, it's not a song that you're going to sing, no matter how strikingly and melodiously, and today everybody sings these days. So that's all very nice and inspiring. But until you get down to actually doing something in terms of engaging in your own life, prayers are powerless. Aspirations are powerless. You invite 20, 30 monks from India or nuns from India or wherever it is, and you make a whole lot of cymbals and trumpets and bone thigh trumpets and all not what all the musical instruments that are there, and then we all go, Om Mani Padme Hum. It's entertaining for one evening. Yeah. And it's good. I'm not saying there are not the blessings. There's tremendous goodness, tremendous blessings in that. But it doesn't bring out the genuine fruition until that method doesn't instill the inspiration to becoming responsible for the actions that you are generating in your life. That you are connected to Dhamma, either by sort of curiosity or by practice. If you're really a devoted Buddhist practitioner, or if you're someone just sort of finding out more about Buddhist Dharma, that simple connection itself must be taken further by engaging in generating that sense of awareness of responsibility of your attitude, of your conduct. So if the change comes, you will create enlightenment here. There's nowhere else to go. Now, if you don't bring that change in you, even if you get a passport to go into an enlightened Buddha field, you'll create the same samsara over there. That's how skillful we are. Isn't it? So the same neurotic mind, untamed mind, sense of non-awareness, with that kind of an attitude, if you go into, let's say, if there is a Buddha field, so far untouched by neurosis, then we go in, I go in. 6 months tops will make us another samsara there, as confusing as this one. But one sane person, and by sanity we mean someone who recognizes the pure nature that is in no need of the chaos, no need of the klesha, the discursiveness. If you can be courageous enough to look that your pure mind can remain same, you can still talk, make friends, marry, have a job, bear children, run a Dharma center, run away from a Dharma center, whatever it is. You can drive, you can stop at the red light, you won't get a parking ticket, or if you do, you know what to do. All of these things remain the same, but it doesn't have to be attached with or connected or mixed with the kleshas. You can still, if you have the insight, the awareness, and the awareness supported by courage, a courage that is convinced, that is confident of one's own pure nature, that has no place for aggression, that has no place for selfishness, that has no place for jealousy, for arrogance. Maybe not entirely pure, pure, no sign of desire, hatred, arrogance, or so forth, but minimized. That it doesn't have place for big angers, long-term angers, for grudges. That it feels the anger, but it forgets the anger just as quickly. It feels the selfishness, but is able to let go of it just as easily. If the fluidity that is more in touch with the pure nature arises, then there is no need to run away from this world. This world is good as it is, and that's how we see. In some of our masters, some of our great teachers, if you look carefully, they really have no problems with this world at all. They're in no rush to attain enlightenment the way we are. If you look carefully in the lives of all these great teachers that many of you have had a lot of fortunate circumstance to meet with, if you take, for example, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, how often do you see him talking about my wish to be enlightened? Now you take a person who's in theory a Buddhist, knows a lot of substance, knows a lot of information, knows a lot of very profound words, but doesn't actually recognize one's own inherent pure nature and is not able to truly be in touch with it. The more such a gap between theory and action comes, the more this person will talk about enlightenment. Then for this person, there's a destination to go to, things to run away from, a place to go to, something to obtain. And so in engaging with our own practice, it is something that has to be kept in mind. It has to be clearly realized what Buddha's teachings or the essence of Buddha Dharma actually means. So in that way, the vows that we talk about should be seen in that way. Vows are not rules and regulations that are imposed on people. Vows are a way of saying, with humbleness, with humility, how much help you need to bring about this awareness of your own pure nature, and how many things would you like to be free from all those sort of causes and possibilities of distraction, and those that bring about sort of forgetfulness about your own pure nature. And so, Tantra vow holders are said to be some of the very brave ones. Tantra vows are not easy to keep. They're very difficult. But if one is able to keep, there's a much courageous approach to retaining and being inseparable from one's own pure mind, pure nature. Bodhisattva vows are designed in such a way that they enable a method of transformation of every arising thought to, instead of being directed towards neurosis and affliction or discursiveness, to be directed towards a positive attitude. And therefore, a positive attitude that is much more closer in resembling your own pure nature. Now, Pratimoksha vows, that what we are talking about this evening, are one of the most honest approaches to training one's own self. Because the Pratimoksha vows take on external circumstances as being very, very powerful. Environment very powerful, people living in the environment, the animate and the inanimate phenomena, both as being very powerful, powerful in the sense that they can cause your mind to sort of be blackmailed into, again, a state of distraction, non-awareness. Therefore, Pratimoksha vow is a very realistic approach to a humble approach, a approach of humility and honesty that recognizes how fragile your awareness is, how fragile and how very weak one's mindfulness is. So these are the three vows that are taught in the Buddhist tradition. As I began with this evening, without the maintaining of vows, it will be very difficult to then talk about what is very popular in the West today, training the mind. Everyone talks about how should I tame my mind, how should I train my mind. And so it's all done in good, I think, interest as well as with a very lot of what today I feel are very sweet, the sort of aspirations of many people. But often I do wonder how serious you are about that, because training the mind and taming the mind must involve doing a lot of things that you don't like. You must be aware of that, isn't it? So somewhat, if you're aware of it, then the Pratimoksha vows won't be very difficult. Now, if one is not aware of the fact that training the mind involves giving up a lot of things you like, doing a lot of things you don't like, agreeing with a lot of things that you will find difficult to agree with, disagreeing with a lot of things that you would love to agree with, and sort of having to be able to give up your own personal ideas, tastes, what you would like to see, what you would like to hear. And so sometimes you have to question yourself and say, how important is it, what you hear, and that be nice? How important is it? What you see should be in accordance to what you wish to see. How important is that? Sensations, feelings, and emotions, how important is that? Now, that's very important in the West. Everything is about how do you feel, isn't it? Do you feel connected to? Now, I've been joking about this year, you know. You all talk about feeling connected to this, feeling not connected to that. There is no room for your connections or no room for your, what do you say, disconnections, not feeling the connections. When it comes down to the matter of training your mind, those that you feel connected has to also be let go of. Those you don't feel connected to also has to be let go of. You cannot suppose that, yes, those that you do not like do not have to be connected to. You let go of few things that you are liking, that you sneak behind you, and you're unwilling to compromise on those. Then when that kind of a sort of a trickiness, the slyness of the mind comes, then that exposes to you, hopefully, as a meditator at that moment, hopefully to the meditator what is exposed is the amount of sort of deceptions and incredible cleverness of the egoistic mind that will not give up so very easily. What it most is afraid of is the pure nature, because without, if the pure nature is recognized, it just cannot sustain. It doesn't have the nourishment that it requires. Mistaken belief are the nourishments, resources of strength and power of the ego mind. Therefore, the mind's sort of slyness and the cleverness with which it creates a deception that distances within the practitioner and creates a tremendous gap between theory and actualization of the practice has to be exposed, has to be understood and seen within one's own self. If that is not seen, then fruition doesn't happen. And when fruition doesn't happen, everyone becomes frustrated. And when you get frustrated, you go around changing teachers, changing practices, changing books, changing dharma centers, changing sanghas, spouses sometimes, isn't it? You go around shifting around external things rather than beginning to have the courage and the insight to say that that's not what it is. What is important is the intrinsic mind that you have to recognize and a clear understanding, as the Buddha himself said. In the intrinsic mind does not require 100 of those things that you do constantly, that you think constantly, that you exert so much effort in constantly. So the Buddha's teachings evolved with that understanding that the Buddha imparted. And so in the text, some sections of the text that I will do over here, it begins, the teachings on the three vows itself begins with the expounding or some explanation given on how the Buddha actually taught on the three vows and for what reason. And what we've just spoken about is just a summation of that particular section. Now, the three vows, as I said, Pratimoksha, Bodhisattva, and the Tantra vows, the very fundamental or the backbone of the Buddhist teachings, taught by the Buddha himself, but evolved through time in accordance to the changes that were happening, changes particularly from the practitioners' relationship to their own path of practice. In Tibet, these teachings began to be compiled as the three vow teachings, and it is a full volume of teachings that were first put together by Ngari Penchen, one great learned master and known as the emanation of King Trisong Deutsen, who was responsible for bringing Buddhism into Tibet. And through the teachings brought in from the great masters of India, particularly Shantarakshita, and his teachings then gathered together by Ngari Penchen, became the very source of the three vows. Later masters beginning, continuing on into the centuries, especially between 14th century and 19th century, tremendous amount of work were done in commenting upon Ngari Penchen's commentaries. Now, in 17th century and 18th century, the great master Lochen Dharmashiri, one of the greatest scholars and masters of Tibet, he composed what is known as the most detailed commentary based upon the root text of Ngari Penchen's Ascertaining the Three Vows. So although Ngari Penchen's Three Vows and then the commentary of that by Dunjum Rinpoche is available in English, one should read that, one should study that. But Lochen Dharmashiri's text is not been translated, also because of the immense amount of work that is there. It's a very detailed text. And so, of course, with now the growing number of number of translators, I'm sure effort will be made towards that direction. But it is a very essential text that must be studied. The classical text must be studied by all practitioners. It combines, basically, the teachings of the Buddha, and the Buddha taught the teachings which are commonly known as 84,000 tenets, 21,000 tenet teachings, primarily towards how to develop an antidote towards the afflictive emotion of anger, of desire. Second, 21,000 more teachings the Buddha taught were primarily focused upon how to overcome the afflictive emotion of anger. And then the third 21,000 teachings as antidotes to ignorance, and then 21,000 more teachings as supplementary teachings on how one can overcome all three afflictive emotions of desire, anger, and ignorance collectively. So what does that mean? It means there's no teaching in Buddhism that is not directed towards the single purpose of overcoming desire, anger, ignorance. Now, how can we today forget that so very easily? We all practice very well, but anger management is sometime in the future. We all dedicatedly do our numbers and sittings, isn't it? Look at the things you all own if you're a Buddhist. Every latest thing that has been invented is there. Every translation, every book, every mala, not only one mala, but a red one, blue one, green one, stone one, wooden one, old one, bone one, brought from Tibet, some from Nepal, you know, gifted to you, you brought it. So there's a whole collection. Every Buddhist home I go to, there's all these paraphernalias that are there. Thangkas, big, small, the pictures, what you wear around your neck, so all of those things. But if that is done in accordance with that, combined together with that, if there is each year a remarkable and a significant decrease in self-cherishing attitude, then you're in the right way. Now, if self-cherishing attitude is being pickled somewhere, you know, it's kept, and you're going to address it at the very last moment when you're about to die, and they say there are three long breaths that you take, then the third long breath, if you say, I see the empty nature of desire, it's a little bit too late. But we may not put it in so many words, but if we look at our attitude and the way we live with our practices, sometimes it seems that this is something that we are all hoping to do, or assuming is all right to do. And so that's then not dharma, that's not practice. And so today, you know, I come up with this new word, loyalists versus practitioners. So if one is loyal to the idea of Buddhism, then that is probably all right. Then one must not claim to be a practitioner. But if one is claiming to be a practitioner, then one is practicing what the Buddha taught in the 84,000 tenets. And therefore, all the practices that you are doing, practicing, listening to, are antidotes to these diseases, to these three neuroses. Therefore, they have to be overcome. That must be evident in your practice, in your own conduct, day-to-day practice. So these 84,000 tenet teachings, as they were taught by the Buddha throughout his lifetime, the whole Buddhist tradition was based upon oral transmissions. Buddha was very much against documenting, writing, and recording his teachings, which is, I think, an exceptional thing to do. Because, of course, in today's world where you all want to have videos and MP3s and CDs of everything and recordings and so forth, one understands. And, of course, as my memory begins to fail, I am heavily dependent also on recordings these days. But on the other hand, if you look at what Buddhism is and what the main intention of the Buddha's teachings is, then writing or systemizing something would almost be assuming that every human being is not an individual, but a herd of sheep. If you all make the same mistakes, if you all have the same causes and conditions, if you all have same level of hopes, same kind of insecurities, same aspirations, same level of exertion and energy, then there could be the same kind of teachings given to everyone. Systemizing teachings is extremely difficult if seen from a Buddhist perspective, which stresses enormous respect for the individual approach of the practices. We teach dharma, but each dharma taught to a person must be engaged upon by each person individually. How Tracy leads her life in accordance with the dharma is very different from Joe Lux's. Joe Lux's is very different from Michelle. Michelle's is very different from Ani Jigme and so forth. So we all hear the same teachings. Anger must be abandoned is the same teaching. It's a general teaching. But with what context, in what context, with what highs and lows, in what occasions, levels of hope and fear associated with that, degrees of the strength of karma, habitual patterns, her own fault, the fault of the others, situational instances, individual instances. There are gamut of facets that are there that must be considered when it comes to the process of transforming of self, working with one's own self. Therefore, keeping that in mind, Buddha himself never really allowed things to be documented, things to be written down, and left it for each individual to hear clearly and engage and find one's own path towards the realization of one's own inherent Bodhi mind or the Buddha mind. Then he passed away at the age of 83. And then, of course, it is said historically, most of the brilliant minds passed away with him and soon after him and were left behind, of course, many good and many more confused. And so then here comes the wisdom of documenting things. A lot of arguments, quarrels, groups, schisms began to take place where every person who could speak the loudest often said, what one had heard was the most correct version of the Buddha's teachings. So because of that, many of the elders or the very highly realized students of the Buddhas came together to then what is known as the gathering of the First Council, which is then historically seen as the documenting of the teachings. And from that, we find the 84,000 tenet teachings being brought down into a one format, which is called the Tripitakas: the Sutra teachings, the Vinaya teachings, and the Abhidhamma teachings. And so it is said that during the time of the Buddha, the Sutra teachings were all gathered together and taught, retaught, and documented by the greatest, one of the greatest heart sons of the Buddha himself, Ananda. Upali, another monk and great arahat, great practitioner, but more known as a person who in his entire lifetime had never done anything harmful to any other sentient being, was seen as the perfect person to teach the Vinaya teachings. So this lineage that we have today of the vows particularly of the Vinaya tradition, the Pratimoksha tradition, come from the great Bodhisattva, great master Upali. Mahakashyap was another great heart son and master of the student of Buddha, and he expounded the Abhidhamma teachings. So the three pitakas, or the three baskets of teachings, sutra, or oral translations or oral teachings of the Buddha, the Vinaya, which is the disciplines and vows, the various ethical modes of ethics or moral ethics practices of the Buddhist tradition, they were all the Vinaya teachings, and the Abhidhamma, which is called the science of Buddhism, or all the teachings related to mind and the nature of mind, the investigative methods of meditation, all of these teachings are gathered within the Abhidhamma teachings. So these three form the basic structure of the Buddhist teachings. So from Upali's instructions and teachings, of course, the tradition of the Vinaya began to be propounded, to be practiced. And Vinaya ran into many, many different kinds of challenges because Vinaya, as it is taught, now here we are using the term vows, but Vinaya, the Sanskrit term, simply refers to humility. Vinay is the term from where the term Vinaya comes. In English, you pronounce it as Vinaya, but the traditional Sanskrit term is Vinay. Vinay simply means humility, where the ego is completely cut through, and sustenance of the ego, desire, ignorance, and anger completely cut off. That practice is then seen as the Vinaya practice. So Vinaya evolved then through the various ages or the transitions of the periods of time. A lot of the teachings were given, but generally the Vinaya teachings itself come from the Buddha's own words. So a very brief quote from the text itself here is from the Buddha when he says, not committing any evil or negative action, fostering or generating all that which is virtuous, a cause of happiness to the others, mindfully with awareness, watching carefully one's own mind and taming it. These three essences are the entirety of the Buddha's teachings. So in that, from this quote, which is considered to be very essential, not committing any unvirtuous action, is seen the birth of what is today known as the Hinayana tradition. Those who faithfully adhere to the first instruction of the Buddha, not committing any evil actions which might become a cause of unhappiness and suffering to self and others. Then the second line, which says fostering or maintaining all that is virtuous, all that is a cause of happiness for the others, generating it, strengthening it. This became the growth, the idea from which the growth of the Mahayana tradition evolved. And then the third line, which says watching carefully, developing awareness, mindfulness of one's own mind, taming one's own mind. This third line of the quote became the origin from where Vajrayana tradition evolved. Now, all three are the Buddha's words, and therefore it is with that that most teachers say there is no distinction between the three jhanas. So through times, of course, a lot of people have segregated themselves into, say, I'm Hinayanist, I'm Mahayanist, and how dare the Mahayanist call the Hinayanist Hinayanist, and what is this Vajrayana anyway, and so forth. So these are all sort of misconceptions that have come later. They have substance to it. It's not just that randomly some people are criticizing. They've had enough reasons to for these different kinds of sort of talks to happen. But that's a different topic altogether. What is essential to know is to be able to attain the very core fruitioning of realizing the enlightened inherent mind. One must engage in all three practices in one's life. You may not know what meditation is, it's perfectly fine. You may not know any of the Buddhist terminology, that's very fine. Even in this room, if you think these are so many words I don't know, that's very fine. Even if you are not doing anything that is traditionally what is called practice, that's also very fine. So long as one is able to keep in mind not committing any creation of unvirtuous action that is a cause of suffering to the others, if you are mindful always of encouraging yourself, of fostering causes that are good for the others, you go out of your way to actually bring happiness to the others. And if you are able to watch your mind such that there is genuine taming of your mind, and that is, you hold the reins of your own mind. If it is about to break loose into aggression, you pull it back. If it goes that way into self-cherishing attitude, you know how to bring it back. If it is going into becoming jealous and arrogant, you are able to bring it back. Then there is no need to really do anything other. This is the essence in which all the teachings of the Buddha are gathered. Now, many people like the first one. You don't have to meditate, you don't have to practice, you don't have to prostrate, you don't have to visualize. That's all very nice. Don't do it, but do this. Now, if you don't do this, then there's no way to keep you out of trouble. You need a babysitter. That's where meditation methods come in. That's where mantras. Meditation will make you sit quietly, without disrupting and bringing unhappiness in the lives of the others. The whole of New York City is safe for the 15 minutes that you are in your meditation cushion. Mantra will keep you silent for a while. Visualization will train your mind for a while. So that's how the methods of Vajrayana are. It is about taming one's own mind. But that needs to be understood. And so the best is when the methods are able to enhance and bring about the permeating of the essence of the teachings of the Buddha Dharma. In the same sutra, again, within the Vinaya teachings, the Buddha again says, taming the mind, now which is the core, do not bring any harm to the others, cultivate good. But both of them are possible only from a tamed mind. Taming the mind, however, requires it to be disciplined, and that's where the Vinaya teachings come. The vows are methods of taming one's own mind, from where such then it always engages in bringing only causes of goodness for yourself and others and refrains from creation of negative and unvirtuous causes and conditions. Therefore, again, the Buddha says, mind is the main factor and forerunner of all actions. When you sit in meditation, you have to really be able to think about this. It is true. Blame for any situation can be put to others, causes and conditions. But ultimately, if you do not react, if the mind doesn't react to whatever is arising, there is no way for it to become multiplied or grow strong. The story can be very short, isn't it? So I always give the example of soap operas. Soap operas are a good example. You can go on and on and on and on and on and on and on, isn't it? So some of them, I was much younger when they were there. They're still there. Once when we die, it'll still be there probably. And reincarnations will still be happening probably. So it's like that. But just as the soap opera is just a small depiction of human commentary, human mind, and the commentary with which it can exaggerate and never be satiated with prolonging things to just continually make it go on and on and on. Therefore, one must recognize that everything can be kept short. Thoughts, enjoy it. As a Buddhist, there is a presupposition you're not supposed to have thoughts. It's never going to happen until you die. So have thoughts. There's no problem with that. Thoughts are empty in nature. There's a luminous, bright, empty nature, appearances of the mind. Those are all very nice. But have thoughts. There's no problem. Emotions, also have emotions. Sensations, yes. Feelings, fine. Keep it short. That's the point. So keep it very short. Having them is not a problem. But the sort of stickiness, the on the soap opera part of it, that goes on, that's what's problematic. Therefore, in order to be able to recognize it, look, as the Buddha said, mind is the main factor and forerunner of all actions. If with a cruel mind one speaks or acts, misery, suffering follows, just as the cart follows the horse. Just as the cart follows the horse, it is true. If the mind is cruel, if the mind creates causes of suffering, of pain, well then, all heaven and earth, as we say, becomes full of suffering. So it's a saying, common saying among Tibetans. If the mind is pure, heaven and earth is pure. If the mind is cruel, heaven and earth is cruel. And that is how it is that if you look at what you are projecting, how your mind projects things, it is dependent upon that mind's projection, how the situation, the environment, the experience, and the circumstance is going to evolve. Power of mind, therefore, must be recognized. Likewise, the Buddha says, if with a pure mind one speaks or acts, just as with the suffering, happiness also follows, just as the shadow that never leaves one's body, in the same way, happiness, causes of happiness, situations, the circumstances of happiness are never separate from one's own self. And so, to be able to really reflect, as we are talking about vows and disciplines, is that sense of discipline is important in order to bring the tamed mind. If the mind is neurotic, then the situation it creates is also very neurotic. If the mind is peaceful, if the mind is content, if the mind is able to rest quietly, still, then everything settles down. The entire environment settles down into contentment, into equanimity, into peacefulness. Therefore, being able to really recognize, as the text says, with the power of one's own mind. Because, now, one of the crucial things in the Vinaya, as it is taught, is this particular line, which says, mental attitude and concepts are formed by habits. So what are concepts? What are our attitudes? Mental attitudes, all the concepts that with which we live with, are formed by habits which become strong simply because we cannot think or act or function independently of them. So we continually keep them. We cannot live life, we think, or we allow ourselves to almost believe that we cannot live free, independent of our habitual patterns, because that's our identity. So all of these layers of habitual patterns, the speediness, the unknowingness, the scatteredness, the confusion, the hope, the resonance of all the different kinds of anxiety, anxiousness, not being clear, the murkiness, all of this are sustained simply because we assume that this is our nature, this is who we are, and therefore it needs to be sustained. We never question it. We never try to be free from it. And because we sustain it, we think it's necessary to be angry. We think it is necessary to be unkind. We think it is necessary to walk around confused and dazed, because this is our identity, because this is how we should be. Because if this is not, what are we? And so we're so afraid to be without anger. We're so afraid to be without our pride. We're so afraid to be without our sort of abrasive attitude and personalities. And so that kind of feeds in, the ego feeds in into that sense of insecurity that it makes you believe is important, because in the insecurity lies the security of the ego. And therefore, the whole sort of pattern with which we live in becomes very important to recognize. And so Buddha says, discipline engaging in the vows, cultivating the vows, and engaging in the practice of discipline protects us from becoming subject or becoming prey to such strong habits of aggression, of self-absorption, of laziness, ignorance, distraction, and so on. And therefore, the Pratimoksha vows, which is the first of the vows that is spoken, are clearly defined in the text as avoiding all sources. Pratimoksha vows are way of avoiding all sources of afflictions, and particularly those different causes that lead to repetitive habits. So if you look at Pratimoksha vows, which are mainly, there is the three beginning vows which are practiced also by householders, lay householders. But primarily, all of the remaining six vows, or the five vows, are practiced by monastics. And becoming a monk, becoming a nun in the Tibet, in the Buddhist tradition, is not so much in the same way as other traditions of becoming monks and nuns. Monks and nuns who take on the Pratimoksha vows are actually sort of practicing this direct instruction of the Buddha, is by living a style of a life, cultivating a method of living that allows you to genuinely avoid all the sources of affliction, allows you to be free from repetitive, sort of repeatedly being sort of drawn into habitual patterns. So whatever gives you actually a way of breaking free from your habitual patterns is a way of cultivating the discipline of the Pratimoksha vows. And so in general, in a sort of comparison between the other vows, the Pratimoksha vows are the easiest to keep and most easy, easily identifiable, easy to sort of remember them, very easy to maintain, which in the modern world, it's very, very opposite, isn't it? You all think Tantra is the easiest, Bodhisattva is very sort of the favorite, as I said earlier. And then monks and nuns, everybody gets scared of becoming nuns. And, no. If I even, you know, a joke sometimes doesn't go well. Do you want to become a monk? Then they all, oh, I'm in the wrong place. I didn't know that this was going to happen. So now, take it seriously, isn't it? You're here to hear a Dharma talk. Why are you here? Now, based upon my assumption as a teacher, why you are here, if I come and say, good, become monks and nuns, how many would actually stay back? Now you'll say, of course, this is enough. Now you'll say everyone, isn't it? But if you look carefully, what I'm pointing out towards is this difference. One has to see in one's own self how much is the gap between theory and action. And it's for each individual to see within one's own self how big or small that gap is. I'm not being critical here, but it's a fact. Because that gap is the one, as long and as far or close it is, that will always be the distance between you and your enlightenment. So, enlightenment, we all aspire. Walking on that path, if there is a little bit of hesitation and doubt, then that doubt and hesitation is the best thing to look at, because that is what will sustain habitual patterns. No one imposes habitual patterns on one's own self. One sustains it. One sustains it because of the hope, because of the fear. What is hope? What is fear? Is to retain habitual patterns. And that through the retaining of the habitual patterns, that you will not be lost. And what will not be lost? We say, I will not be lost. And therefore, the teachings do encourage you to say, what do you mean by I? What is the nature of the I? And so the Prajnaparamita teachings, the Mahayana teachings, are all about investigating what is the nature of self. Hinayana teachings' focus is on understanding what is the nature of self. And so what is the nature of the self? And within, it's very easy, as many of you have heard hundreds of times. Nature of self is imagination. A vivid imagination that there is something. Other than an imagination, other than an assumption, it's just a letter of the alphabet. But it's powerful. It's very powerful. And so the whole struggle between samsara and nirvana is between this powerful concept versus being able to overcome that and be able to be prepared to embrace what reveals beyond the conceptual belief of what we presuppose the self to be. So in order to be able to go through that transition, to be able to build up that confidence, to be so brave to overcome this kind of a supposition or a concept of an ego-based mind, disciplines become the very perfect practice, the very helpful practices. In the words of Pathur Rinpoche, he says, as far as admirers are concerned, there are plenty of admirers of the pure mind. But the admiration alone of the Dhamma and the truth of the Dhamma isn't sufficient. That's religion. If you're admiring something to such a degree that you're going to whole life long follow it faithfully, that's religion. Is it good? Is it bad? Neither. It is good for those who won't do even that much, and it is not good for those who can see better. Because if you fall into that category, you become a truly dedicated, loyal, religious person, stays away from a lot of harm, but not necessarily is what Buddhism was intended for. And so to be a true engaged practitioner, one has to not only admire something, but be able to embody it. And so the question to one's own self is, at this level, how much is the admiration, how much is the engagement? And so in that way, the vows are given to the people. The pratimoksha vows are the first levels that are given. Now, before I go a little bit into what are the vows itself, although the topic of the vows itself is very big, so I'll try to sort of condense it a little bit. But in terms of the vows itself, now, I was earlier talking about the councils and the schisms that happened. During the time, the first council compiled the Tripitaka teachings, from where the Vinaya teachings also come, as I mentioned that earlier. But then further, again, 110 years after the first council, then again further sort of dissension and schisms began to arise, particularly based upon what are five crucial points. And these, I think, are very important for Buddhists today to understand, because the five misunderstandings that began to arise, which led to the formation and the calling of the second council, were said to be the distortions that were allowed. Some of the Buddhist teachers began to teach that to have doubt was permitted, that it is good, actually, to have doubt. Now, if you look carefully, that's again happening in today's Buddhist world, is where people almost encourage each other to have doubt. So where is the encouragement to go beyond doubt and hesitation, or where is it misplaced or distorted, where you're sympathetic to the doubt and the hesitation? So if there are teachings, if there are places where you are hearing sympathy to the doubt that you are having, primarily because the one you're talking to may have doubts himself, herself, and so it's sort of, let's all get into the what I call the welfare council of all doubters and hesitators. You know, we all are very good at groupism. We immediately gather group. All the angry people get together. All the sort of selfish people gather together. So all the ones who have doubt and hesitation, excellent. This is the age for doubt and hesitation. We sustain that. So where the teachings, instead of breaking free from doubt and hesitation, encourages, that then is repeating the same mistake that happened around 110 years after the Buddha passed. Some teachers began to talk about that. Second distortion, according to the Vinaya, why the Vinaya had to be strengthened. Now, because of this, why I'm mentioning this is also because why monasticism became very important and why the vows in monasticism became very important is you have to know monks and nuns were the teachers at that time. They still are. Most of those from whom you study the Dharma are those who actually have the vows. Likewise, in those times, all the teachers were monastics, and therefore, when the monastics themselves began to promote distorted ideas, that then distorted the whole idea, the essence and the meaning of the Buddha Dharma itself. Second distortion was the nourishing the concept of self, as it is called. And so it's very good to think about yourself. When that is the predominant message that is being given disguised in the form of teachings, where teachings and methods of meditations are actually sort of covert ways of cherishing the self, where teachers begin to say, you should think about yourself, of course, and in a very sympathetic attitude. For example, if I come in into a room and I begin to talk to you in a very soft and a gentle way, you know, you're a very kind Buddhist, very good Buddhist, wonderful, you know, everything is beautiful, everything is nice, do what you can, you must know yourself, your own mind is the very kind mind, nurture it like a chicken or a sparrow, you know, sort of a whatever beautiful image that a chicken is not such a beautiful one, so yeah. A budding flower, and then, you know, let the rays of the sun flow on the budding flower and bloom and smile and so forth. Some of you will be caught up in that, isn't it? Because it's feel good. It helps you. Now, bringing the mind from an untrained state into a trained state by sort of taking the help of such ideas or methods, that's also very good. There are many, many excellent methods such as these that are helpful for bringing otherwise what would be a very sort of a sensitive mind to the path of practices. You know, I know, many of us have gotten here because of such a method that we had taken. So there's good credit must be given there. But on the other hand, when it is sustained over a long period of time, then it becomes anti-essence of the Buddhist teachings, which is not given with the concept idea of self-cherishing attitude. To guard the self as being important, to be proud to be a Buddhist, to take pride in your practice, to become arrogant with your lineage, to take your practice as so solid and so form-oriented that it becomes competitive with the center next door. Such tendencies of selfishness, of self-cherishing attitude, should not be practiced by any Buddhist meditator. That is against the Buddhist teachings itself. Degenerate times come because this is then promoted. And therefore, as Buddhism begins to become more and more practiced in the West, this is something you all have to understand. The age of naively following things, blindly following things, is long gone. So now where you have access to so much teachings and classical and actual teachings, sort of always relating to watered-down Buddhism is not good. That should be left for many people who are on the beginning stages of practice, for whom some of the very sort of heavy-duty classical approaches can be very difficult for the mind to take. Then that is there. But as I look in the room, there are many of you who've been Buddhist for 30 years, 40 years, still doing it in little bits and pieces is then, I think, not helpful for your own individual liberation and for the aspiration of benefiting others. So anyway, second is then the nourishing the concept of self. To imagine is the third distortion that was brought, that you could imagine Dharma to be what you would like it to be, and that it was quite all right to do so. Relative phenomena is quite real. This is the world that we live in. But each relative phenomena, from the Buddhist perspective, must be explored to unearth the absolute nature. What is the absolute nature of all phenomena must be seen in the light of it having a single taste, one taste, as it is said, the taste of inherent empty nature. All phenomena, animate and inanimate, if really looked at carefully, analyzed for what it truly is a buildup of compoundedness, compositeness of many factors, where the compoundedness and the interdependency of all compoundedness is understood. What happens is such a mind begins to have a much more relaxed attitude to its relationship to everything that is working with. We are unable to have a relaxed attitude, which often is called the altruistic attitude. Now, what is altruism? What is kindness? What is compassion? It's to have a little relaxed attitude, relaxed from bias, relaxed from agendas, relaxed from different kinds of emotional neuroses. And so where you can look at something objectively with a freer spirit, being able to understand its oneness rather than its diversity. So where that bias is strong, discrimination, and discrimination builds all kinds of negativities. So to be able to cut through that discrimination and bias, it is very crucial for the mind to understand the unique oneness of all phenomena, that ultimately everything begins from the same ground, that there are compoundedness and compositeness, interdependencies that actually begin to create a diversity of the relative phenomena, but ultimately the nature is the fundamental oneness. When the oneness is understood, there is no animosity to some, neither is there partiality to the others. A sense of much more a one sort of approach, a single approach, a very tolerant approach, and a much more pervasive and a flexible approach to self and the others, the environment, can be generated. Now, that being the very crucial point of the Buddhist practices, how to cultivate such an understanding, such a realization, however, encounters the difficulties. The difficulties come when teachers themselves begin to say, no, that is true, but it's beyond your reach. Right now, you can imagine what you like. And you begin to have your own imagination of what enlightenment might be. And it's all right. You begin to imagine what the nature of shunyata is, and it's quite all right. You begin to imagine what your practice is, and it's quite all right. That imagination creates hallucination. And hallucination often feeds in to your own senses' greed and craving of what you want it to be. So that's why sometimes people become a Buddhist, and then afterwards they become an obnoxious Buddhist. What's an obnoxious Buddhist? Is a Buddhist who is at war with everything else. Angry Buddhists, cold. Have you met them? Angry Buddhists, proud Buddhists, cold Buddhists. People whom you approach and they look like they've just stepped out of a freezer, isn't it? Crazy Buddhists, as we say. But then allowed to be crazy, allowed to be angry by whom? The teacher. By the belief that this is also a path. And as a teacher, if I sometimes encounter such situations, you can't really talk to such a person sensibly because they are already so very learned in Dharma that they'll come back with even more greater rhetorics and explanations and reasonings that you in terms of ideology and how it is phrased and articulated, it all sounds very true. For example, being neurotic and watching your mind. Now, who can stop you from watching your mind? But while you're watching your mind, you're making the lives of others miserable. And you're allowed to imagine that you can do that. When teachers and the sanghas, when practitioners begin to propound that, when they begin to say that is permissible, then that is again against the Buddhist principle. So that's the third one. Fourth is to have ignorance. And that's something that we take great pleasure in. 2,400 years ago, that was again being taught as being permitted. Today, 21st century again, some of us take great pride in saying, yes, I have ignorance. And how many of us actually do that? You actually walk up to teachers and you smile and shake hands and you say, yes, this is your ignorant student. The teacher's job is to whack the student at that moment. You're not allowed to be ignorant. That's not the sense of complacency. I'm joking about it. Now remember, the whacking didn't go very well with some people behind there. So what I'm here saying is the thought that comes into the mind. I do that only with the nuns. So but in one's own mind, where you begin to become sort of complacent with the idea of ignorance, that ignorance is permitted, what happens? All of these, that what we talked about as distortions, doubt, self-cherishing attitude, imagination, and now here to have ignorance, what happens is it feeds into immediately stemming or cutting your path of progress. You begin to immediately have one of the biggest factors that is the weapon of the discursive root poison, desire, and that is convenience and complacency. Vinaya, for which the pratimoksha vows are the antidote, is said to be the antidote. Vinaya is said to be the antidote of the emotion desire. Desire can come in all various forms. But the subtlest form of desire that inflicts us most as practitioners is convenience and complacency. And all of these, whether it is doubt, whether it is imagination, self-cherishing attitude, or ignorance, are powerful messages that allow the strengthening of the complacency and the convenience to come into our own mind. Where complacency and convenience begin to become very strong in one's own mind, then we do not allow the transformation to be a priority in our path of practice. Now you look at our own lives and our own relationship to our own practices. And I always say, it's not that we do not have devotion. All of us practice with immense amount of devotion. If someone asked me, do you have devotion? I would say, yes. And if someone said, how do you know? I don't have ways to tell this person how I have devotion other than the fact that I know I have devotion. And I'm sure you all, many of you, feel the same way. Based upon such a devotion, we try to be diligent. We try to engage in practice as best as we can. Yet, why is the resultant state still so unclear? Why is it still so difficult to overcome the negativities? It's because of this factor, is that I have devotion, I have diligence, but there is a stealing message that calls to convenience. And what is convenient? Training the mind, succumbing to habitual tendencies. What's more convenient? Complacency in changing and bringing about the transformation, how much is that there? Then I begin to see that, yes, complacency is definitely there. Complacency often outweighs sense of urgency to bringing about the transformation. It outweighs the devotion. It outweighs the mindfulness. And convenience is definitely there. And the convenience doesn't hesitate to blame a dozen other things for which my transformation is not happening. No time, no money, no teaching, no teacher, no place to meditate. You know, the sort of all the different causes and conditions that we begin to say because of which transformation of the mind is not happening. It's not even logical if you look carefully. You cannot transform your mind because you have no time. You cannot transform your attitude from negative to a pure mind because you're too busy. All of these different reasonings that we begin to find are conveniences, excuses that it is looking for, because of which when, if the teacher teaches that it is fine to do, then the actual change and the engaging in the practice does not happen. Likewise, the fifth distortion came about, which is said to be to give incorrect answers. When a teacher says to give incorrect answers is a fine thing to do, then that again allows a deception in your own mind to begin to happen. So to give incorrect answers, you hear incorrectly. What you hear incorrectly, your mind assumes incorrectly. When the mind assumes incorrectly, it stems immediately the progress on the path of practice. To realize truth, one must engage truthfully. It is one's own path of practice. It has nothing to do with what all other Buddhists are doing. So how many people, if you read all those Dharma blogs, for example, how many of them are all about, I'm not practicing anymore because of so-and-so. That Sangha doesn't do well, you stop practicing. Somebody else is divorcing, you stop practicing. Somebody sort of did something wrong, you stop practicing. The elevator at the Dharma Center didn't work, you stop practicing the Dharma. Isn't it? So when those different kinds of things begin to happen, you are again and again blaming external conditions. It is where you're not addressing the very crucial need to address your own mind. It's your mind that is reacting to certain things. How does it react? How does it relate to that unfortunate or fortunate circumstance? Is the same way, is the same situation created by causes and conditions. But that must not impact your enthusiasm to transform, to change, from adhering, from succumbing to the negativities, to really transforming it into generating nothing but genuine goodness, genuine causes of goodness for self and the others. So in history, when these five distortions began to be taught as being permitted, Second Council was held. And it is from the Second Council that we also find the coming together of the Vinaya tradition, where the vows were explained, particularly the Pratimoksha vows were explained. And from that, the Buddhist teachings began into sort of breaking into the first divisions. And you find the first dated historical schools of different kinds evolving. So Buddhist teachings until then were just Buddhist teachings. From that second council, 18 Buddhist schools evolved. And all of these 18 Buddhist schools were said to be Buddhist, authentic, holding Buddhist authentic Buddhist teachings, separation caused only by particular teachers and their concentration on their own students. So that's the 18 school that happened. Later on, these 18 schools also were gathered into what is called the four main Buddhist schools. These four main Buddhist schools began to be known as first Sarvastivada. It's a lot of Sanskrit terms, so I'll have probably much of this written down by Tracy and then plus put somewhere on the door. So if you copy that, that's probably an easier thing to do. Sarvastivada or Mula Sarvastivada tradition began. It was continued or evolved from the teachings and the guidance of Rahul or Rahula, Buddha's son. Second school that evolved was known as the Mahasanghika school. Mahasanghika school began with the teachings of the great Bodhisattva Kashyap or Mahakashyap. The third school that evolved was known as the Sthavira school. And the Sthavira school started with the teachings and the guidance of the great master Katayana. And Samitya school started with the Upali's teachings and Upali's guidance. Now, why these three are necessary to understand in the context of Pratimoksha vows. If you're studying Pratimoksha, you have to understand these different schools, because when you don't know this, you don't understand the importance of lineages. And that becomes very crucial to know. Because, for example, the Tibetan monastic systems, monks and nuns, are formed from the first school, the Mula Sarvastivada school, that began with the Buddha's son, Rahula, is the teachings or the lineage of the Vinaya Pratimoksha that went into Tibet. During the time of Tibet, Padmasambhava and Shantarakshita, the abbot, brought the tradition of monasticism, Vinaya, and introduced the Pratimoksha into the Tibetan to the Tibetan practitioners. But we also see Lang Dharma's great destruction. Many of you are familiar that 200 years after Buddhism went to Tibet, there was a king who decided to destroy all of the Buddhist teachings. And his main sort of target were the Vinaya adherers, or the adherers of the Pratimoksha vows. So he made a law that until, if a monk or a nun refused to become a hunter or a butcher, then everyone would be killed. And so almost all of the monks and nuns during that time in Tibet were killed. And only three great monks, Mar, Yo, and Tsang, these three escaped into the lower regions of Tibet at that time, took with them all the Vinaya teachings, and then taught one person, many monks, but only one survived, Gongpa Rabsal, as his name is referred to as. And so Gongpa Rabsal later, almost 55 years later, brought the Vinaya back into central Tibet. So what we find is in Tibet, the Pratimoksha vows are then divided into, because of this particular situation, political situation in the country, three streams of the Vinaya tradition evolved, what was called the Tödul, Bardul, and the Medul, the Vinaya of the upper regions, Vinaya of the central regions, and Vinaya of the lower regions. Now, in terms of the Gelugpas and the Nyingmapas, most of them adhere to the lineage of the lower regions. If you look at the Sakyas and the Kajupas, most of them will have the lineage traced back to the middle, or the Bardul, as it is called, the middle lineage of the transmissions. But what has to be understood, for example, when you talk about nuns' ordination, today many of you are very aware of this situation, because during this 10th century and 11th century's invasion and destruction of Buddhism, the fully ordained nuns' pratimoksha lineage ended at that time, and it could never be revived. Only the monks' lineage survived. So we do not have the fully ordained nuns' lineage in Tibet, never could be revived for these last 800-900 years. Now today, for most people who don't understand pratimoksha vows, it's a very difficult thing to understand. Why a Tibetan nun cannot go to China or Taiwan or Korea, where they have the nuns' fully ordained tradition, receive the vows, come back, and then bestow and continue with the lineage. So if you know the actual ways in which the traditions began, the schisms happened, and then the different schools evolved, and how they branched to, we find that there is no trace of any surviving female ordination lineage within the Mula Sarvastivada tradition, the tradition that went into Tibet. So that tradition exhausted. Now, other traditions like the Samitya or the Mahasangika and so forth, they have a living tradition in China, in Korea, in Hong Kong, in Taiwan, and so forth. That's where the Mahayana and the Theravada nuns' fully ordination tradition does go. So now the scholars who know this have a problem. And they say nuns can go and individually receive in other traditions, but they cannot come back because they would be then bringing in a completely new school of lineage. And there, that is not the same as the Mula Sarvastivada tradition being brought back. So you'd have to go back to time and bring someone surviving from the Mula Sarvastivada tradition in that. And so because of this, a lot of the complications about whether it is permissible for another tradition to be brought into the Tibetan tradition, what happens to then the Tibetan tradition? Does it remain Tibetan tradition or does it become the Chinese tradition? So then that whole question complicates the matter. So I just wanted to mention this because a lot of people think, what is this whole this problem? Can't they just go and get 6 incenses poked on their hair and take up all the ordination and come back? So if one doesn't know, it's a very simple solution. You just go and take your ordination. But if you know history and you know the intricacies of how lineage has to be transferred, then you find that the choices between keeping a Mula Sarvastivada tradition alive or then would you become Samatya? And then that would change history completely because then the Tibetan tradition would exhaust and then another tradition would come in. So that's the kind of point that you have to also know to becoming a monk and a nun. So it's terribly complicated to become renunciates. You know, it's another thing to do so. However, in that way, as the tradition of the Pratimoksha were given between these 4 schools were the predominant traditions in which the Pratimoksha vows were given. Pratimoksha vows consists of 8 or 7 primarily the vows. The first is known as the Upavasika vows. Now, most of you are familiar with the Nyene, as it is called in Tibetan, or Sanskrit, Upavasika, what is in English terribly transpirated as 24-hour vows vow holder. Now, I don't know how that translation came about, but I think it did because one holds 8 precepts for a period of 24 hours. It is given to householders to be able to engage in a practice that really deals with taming and training one's own mind. So that's the first. It can be taken by both male and female and are called the same, upavasika or lay household householder vows. Second and the third vows are Upasaka and Upasika vows. Upasaka, U-P-A-S-A-K-A and S-I-K-A. Upasaka is for male householders. Upasika is female householders. In this case, either the 8 or the 5 root precepts are kept predominantly by all traditions for a lifetime and by 1 or 2 particular traditions for an indefinite period of time, which is such as 3 months or 4 months or for a year or 3 years or so on and so forth. The third level of the vows, which involves the 4th and the 5th, are called the Shramanera and Shramanerika vows, which are in English often called novice male and novice female. All the Tibetan nuns that you see will have this particular vow. This is the highest that a Tibetan nun can go through. So in the Shramanera and Shramanerika vows, none, according to one's own abilities, may keep 10 or 30 vows, 33 vows, for a lifetime. Then the next sixth vow is called Shikshamana, or in English called the novice in training vows. That is also what a Tibetan nun can aspire to go up to. That's the highest it can go up to. It is called novice in training. Usually it used to be in the traditional or in the monk's category. Novice in training is the in-between time between novice and full ordination, a period of 2 years that you spend where you are not allowed to break even a single vow. And if you fail, either you go back to being a novice or you again take on the commitment for 2 more years. Until then, you are qualified, as the preceptor sees, to take on the very last 2 pratimoksha vows, which are called bhikshu and bhikshuni, or fully ordained monk and fully ordained nun. So a novice in training maintains 33 vows and an additional of 12 vows. So that is the novice in training. And then a fully ordained monk keeps 250 vows. A fully ordained nun keeps 363 vows. All of these, 363, 250, the 42, the 33, the 10, all of the 8 precepts are fundamentally gathered into what are called the 5 primary precepts. They are all subcategorizations of the 5 primary precepts that even a householder must keep, should keep. These 5, the first one is not to kill, not to take life of any sentient being intentionally. The intention is very clearly stated. In some traditions, it is even more clearly stated as not to kill another human being intentionally. So it's very specific, and that is the sort of very details that you have to go into the vows. So when that is not understood, I think one of the mistakes happen is when people say not to kill, and then you are paralyzed with fear as to how can you avoid not killing, because you find beings in food, you find you're driving and your window shield is all filled with the bugs that have splattered. Mm-hmm. So you begin to get very, very upset with you're killing all of this. So I think some of that is sort of felt and not communicated well enough, because in the text, if you really look at the details, there are lots of texts about what is intentional killing, what is the level of killing. Of course, not to kill is the general idea. Not to kill intentionally is the general idea. But there are all of these subtler nuances that have to be there, where human life and not killing human life is very clearly observed. And then, of course, not to kill animals. But in certain situations, what happens? Those have to all be explored. Second pratimoksha vow is not to steal. What is not to steal? What is often defined as not to take anything that is not given to you willingly, which also involves hinting at something and then receiving it. The third is then not to indulge in any sexual activity. In the case of householders, a variation is given between faithfulness to one's partner, and if one is going into the monasticism, then it changes, the fidelity changes into celibacy. So that's up to the levels of vows that you are taking. However, in the case of the 24 hours of the lay householders, then in that case, celibacy has to be taken. There is no compromising in that. 24 hours you can manage is what is the attitude kept in taking the vows. So this was some clarification that, again, after doing the Shedra, somebody asked me about that. So that's why I wanted to touch base on that. Now, the fourth precept that one takes is not to lie. And in the case of talking about it generally, we usually say not to lie. But if one studies pratimoksha and one takes pratimoksha vows, it is then lying is seen as not lying about any meditative or a meditative potential, capability, or realization that one may have. And so it is said to be lie connected to your own individual realization. You have to keep in mind again that most of these vows are taken by monks and nuns who receive a lot of veneration from the others. And when veneration is given, it's very deceptive. People assume you are pure. You have to walk around imagining or pretending to be pure. And sometimes when you project that, that's the catch here, is that when someone says, do you have certain kind of realization? And then if you lie about that, that's the particular kind of lie that is not given. In the case of householders, lie are given in a variety of branches, mainly slandering, gossiping, harsh speech, and lie that is going to harm somebody else are all grouped together in the precept of not lying. The fifth precept that is taken, that is the main root precept, is not to take any intoxicants. Any intoxicant that instigates or instills in oneself lack of mindfulness. And with lack of mindfulness comes everything else. And therefore, any kind of intoxicants are not to be taken. That's generally said. In the thorough or the detailed explanation of the Vinaya, then time frame and amounts are specified. If an amount is suggested for health reasons, that is permitted. If for health reasons a certain duration is needed through the permission of the preceptor for that duration of time, any kind of medicine or any kind of thing that has an intoxicant is permitted. But when it comes to householders, for example, taking the precepts, then it is generally kept as no alcohol, no intoxicants of anything that must be abstained for the duration of time that you have taken. So these are the five basic root precepts. And then ultimately, it is a sort of sub-branch or much more finer details of all of these five root sort of disciplines. How they evolved is because of our, I think, very clever mind. The Buddha said, don't steal. And a monk or a nun came up with wonderful ideas that didn't look like stealing, but is actually stealing. So then he adds on one more. And then he says, stealing when a person is known, two people are not in the room, more than two people have to be in a room, and the witness has to be there. So there are all these variations that are there. Slandering knowingly, slandering jokingly, slandering with intent, slandering with aggression, slandering with selfishness. Even slander has 10 different kinds of variations. So when they go into much more detailed explanations, they add up to what is known as 253 and 363 for the nuns. And so again, in the Western mind, a lot of time people say, oh, it's very unjust, nuns have 363, monks have only 250. That again comes from not really understanding, because if you really look at it, 363 are variations of the 250. 250 are variations of the 30. 30 are the variations of the 8. 8 are the variations of the 5 precept. Fundamentally, it comes down to do not kill, do not steal, do not lie, do not indulge in any kind of sexual activity, or be faithful to your partner, do not take any intoxicants. Why so? Is because that is the very basic approach to training your own mind. When you take on the commitment, you actually realize how difficult it is to train one's own mind, how easy it is to wish, how easy it is to think, how easy it is to plan towards it. But when you actually engage and you take on the commitment, it's a very different story altogether. So even in our cases, for example, we are taught to think a great amount of number of years before you take the vows. So you do come and you think for many years, and then suddenly you come to a point in your life where you think, oh yes, it makes sense. I think I can do it. I remember myself when I first took my vows. And so I always give my example. I always thought, yes, killing, one doesn't do necessarily. Intentionally killing, no. Stealing, I don't need to steal. Lying, I don't lie. Sexual intercourse, can do without. Intoxicants, I don't have to take them anyway. So I thought, oh, it's very easy. Normally, I do them anyway. And we always think, normally, I do this anyway. So then we took the vows. And then when you take the vows, and then you realize, then you don't know what to do. Because every day, you're careless with your physical body. You take lives. Speeches, can't even imagine how. You know, there's nothing that I can see. Even the breath sometimes seems to be a lie, isn't it? So everything is exaggeration, everything is deception, Everything is for your own selves, agendas. Mind can be so blind to all these subtle and gross neuroses that are sustained. And so when you look at it from that perspective, you realize how easy and how strongly we are stuck in these habitual tendencies that do not really allow us to go beyond self-grasping, self-cherishing ideas, and therefore how difficult it is and how difficult it will be to break free from these patterns. So in making the commitment, one engages in actualizing the aspiration to be free from creating the causes of suffering for oneself and the others.